Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to this session that is going to be devoted to oral presentations on the ABC in Africa, what is the evidence. And with me is Laurie Garrett, who is co-chair this session. I think this is a very interesting session because this paradigm has been with us for a while, and we are trying to see whether this there is evidence to continue to use this paradigm. At this meeting, there has been several questions about ABC, and maybe after we finish this session, we'll have some corroborative evidence to ensure that we continue to do this, or we might have to change the way we do business. We have four presenters and then somebody who is going to do discussions. And because of the time, we have only about an hour, 15 minutes. We're going to allow each presenter 10 minutes, and then the wrap-up will be another 10 minutes, and then we'll have discussions after that. Now, it is my duty and responsibility now to introduce to you the first speaker on this for this particular session, Kevin O'Reilly, who is a medical anthropologist and epidemiologist, has worked with the World Health Organization for 14 years and CDC for 11 years before then, all in the area of prevention of HIV and AIDS. Indeed, we can say that he's a main actor in the issues of prevention for HIV and AIDS globally. One thing that he wanted me to tell you, and maybe you'll observe it, is that he's tall and handsome. Kevin.
When they ask you to choose what you want to be introduced by, might as well be creative. Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you all for coming. I know it's been a long week with many meetings, and I admire your stamina. What I'm going to present today is a relatively non-controversial review of a relatively controversial topic. A systematic review of the impact of abstinence-based interventions on risk behaviors in developing countries. And I'd like to thank my co-authors, Amy Medley, Julie Dennison, and Mike Sweat, as well as other actors who've helped us do this work. And I'd also like to point out that just following this session at 6 o'clock, there will be a satellite meeting where we will review even more evidence of other interventions as well, including a repeat of this, in case you enjoy it so much you'd like to see it twice. What's the background? Why are we doing this? There, as it's well known, and the reason you're here, I think, is because some donors have targeted funding for abstinence-based interventions and have focused their prevention efforts almost exclusively on that issue. And this is coupled somewhat with a concern that promoting condoms might lead to increased risk and more sexual risk-taking behavior. There's a lot of emotion, a lot of heat, maybe not a lot of light around the topic, and a systematic review is one way to look at what do we really know. So there are strong calls for looking at the evidence and what are the benefits of evidence-based interventions. So the question we addressed with this study is, what evidence for effectiveness is there for abstinence interventions in developing countries? This is part of a project which is a collaboration between the World Health Organization and the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And the goal of the project is to examine the strength of evidence of effectiveness of a variety of HIV interventions in developing countries by systematically reviewing the literature. Now, what do we mean by systematic? I've seen a number of presentations here this week calling themselves systematic reviews, and I think there's some latitude in the way that the term is currently being used. The goal that we have is to try to avoid any bias or post hoc analyses by being explicit on all the decisions that are taken, avoiding any opinion-based approaches, and have work that, producing work that might be reproducible subsequently. So therefore, the project uses systematic methods that are written in advance, describing each step of the process, with quality assurance that is built into the process, including double coding and resolution of discrepancies between coders. Detailed coding instructions and coding forms that we use to systematically extract data from the studies that we find. And written and search and inclusion criteria that are all predefined and used in a very rigorous way. What do we mean by systematic review? Well, for sake of brevity, I won't go through this, but just to say that for a topic that has a lot of emotion, it's very important that we have a way to systematically remove some of that emotion and maintain our objectivity when we're looking at the literature. And that's what this is an attempt to do. So what is it that we looked at in this study? We defined abstinence interventions as any programs or other planned efforts that are intended to increase the rates of abstinence. These can include abstinence-only interventions, or they can include interventions that encourage abstinence along with other risk reduction behaviors, such as condom use. So the topic-specific inclusion criteria were an intervention that encourages abstinence for the purpose of HIV prevention, not for pregnancy prevention, with specific outcomes presented that would include abstinence, delay of sexual debut, incidence of HIV infection, etc. And it had to be published between January 1990 and December of 2004. We did also meta-analysis across the studies to generate a merged effect size of an estimate and to generate confidence intervals for the effects that we found. Here's just a quick flowchart to give you somewhat of an idea of the amount of work that's involved in doing a real systematic review. We started off with 436 potentially relevant articles, and after going through and screening them carefully, we wound up with 10 that met our inclusion criteria. And what did we find? The 10 studies are mostly conducted in Africa that met the inclusion criteria. Two in Zambia, two in Uganda, one each in Namibia, Tanzania, South Africa, and Nigeria, and then one each in India and the Philippines. They used largely randomized control designs, which is sort of interesting, because a lot of the literature that we're looking at is not characterized by randomized control designs. Nine use these designs. Oh, correction here. Eight use these designs. Two use non-randomized designs. Of the outcomes, only six measured actual behaviors. A lot of others measured knowledge, attitudes, and other sorts of and beliefs. But only one study among the whole group tested an abstinence-only intervention. And all the studies, it's important to note, were conducted on adolescents only. One of the things that we do in this particular project as well is to assess the rigor of the studies that we're looking at. We've constructed an 8-point rigor scale that's an additive scale with 1 point awarded for each item. And the items that we use are listed there below. Again, for sake of time, I won't go through reading them, but I would like to point out that these studies scored very high on the rigor scale in general. In fact, of the different interventions we looked at, the average score for these studies was the highest. The reason being that, for the most part, they were randomizing classrooms. And they're randomizing not individuals, but classrooms. And because they're randomizing classrooms, they also had relatively high follow-up rates in participants subsequently. So there's a bit of a skewing toward more rigor on these studies, more rigor than I think that they actually really deserve. But it's an anomaly of our scale. You can see here that two of our studies received a score of 6 points, which is actually pretty high, with the bulk receiving mostly 5 points. What did we find? On condom use, we found three studies that reported changes in condom use. One had significant effects, but a meta-analysis showed no effect across the studies. On abstinence, we found six studies that reported changes in abstinence behavior. Three had significant effects, and a meta-analysis showed significant impact across the studies, but the effect size was minimal. Specifically, in studies in Zambia, Namibia, and Nigeria, looking at condom use following interventions that promoted abstinence as well as other risk reduction behaviors, we found, as you can see, relatively weak effects with fairly wide confidence intervals and a non-significant result. The merged effect was weak, and the confidence intervals indicate that we have an insignificant result here. For abstinence, looking at studies in Zambia, Namibia, Nigeria, Uganda, and Tanzania, we found three of them with insignificant results, but two, primarily in Uganda and Tanzania, which did have significant results. And the one in Uganda is the strongest of all. Owing to that particular study, the merged effect model for the for abstinence was 1.4, which is significant, but still a relatively weak effect. So conclusions, what can we say about what we know about abstinence and interventions to promote it? In fact, we know relatively little. The rigor of the studies that we looked at was, in general, fairly good, but I think it was a bit skewed toward the good. Few of the studies actually measured real behavior. There was interesting information presented in some studies on knowledge and attitudes, and some of that leads to the conclusion that efforts to promote abstinence really needed to be coupled with or consequent to efforts to change gender attitudes first. Only one study that we looked at actually assessed abstinence only. All studies were on in-school youth with behavioral outcomes, which makes it possible to assess the impact on adults. Apologies for the misspelling there. No impacts were found on condom use, either as in a beneficial way, but it also didn't seem to consequently make sexual activity more common and increase condom use. And so what we can say is that, in general, the interventions that we looked at had minimal, significant, but minimal impact on abstinence, but again, only for young people. Thank you.
All the questions at the
end. Thank you, Kevin. We will take all the questions together after the session. And we'll move quickly to the next presentation, which title is A Cow Dies with Grass in Its Mouth, Fisherman's Response to Zero Grazing in Kisumu, Kenya. This should be delivered by Ujili Sharma, who works currently with the Kenya Medical Research Institute and has done so for 5 years. And our main preoccupation is rapid ethnographic studies within understudied populations. She also did art. That I should remark that she's charming. Angela.
Thank you. Good evening. It's truly a pleasure to see so many of you out here when I know you could be right next door watching Stephen Lewis instead. I made this presentation with the help of my colleagues at the Kenya Medical Research Institute and at the University of Washington. Funds for the study was provided by the NIH STI TMCRC project grant. Kenya is in East Africa and has an HIV prevalence of 7%. Nyanza province, which is this part right here, has a prevalence of 15%. And Kisumu district, which is the red, has an even higher burden of disease. So it's postulated that the fishermen who live and work on Lake Victoria in Kisumu district are amongst those who are most at risk for HIV/AIDS. However, there has been no systematic study that examines what these behaviors are, why they're occurring, and even if there indeed is a high HIV/AIDS prevalence in this population. So we talked to 12 groups of 8 to 12 men, fishermen, and we took themes that emerged from these focus group discussions and discussed it with 17 key informants. key informants are people from the industry who are very knowledgeable about what's happening out there and are willing to talk about it as well as be introspective about it. And most of the quotations that you will see come from these key informant interviews. Separately, we also tested for STI-HIV in 250 fishermen. Just to give you an idea of the men that we talked to, all of them were Christian. All but one was of Luo ethnicity, and this is important to remember. And in general, it seems that the key informants were older, more likely to have, you know, basic education, be married, but they earned lesser than men who were in the focus group discussion. To understand these men's sexual behavior, it is important to understand how their work and leisure activities are organized. And essentially, what happens with the fishermen is that they have periods of really heavy work, fishing, whether it's during the day or the night, interspersed with leisure time activities. And the ones I'm going to focus on are drinking, smoking marijuana, and looking for ladies. The reason why men can look for the ladies is because they have the time to do so. They have the money with which they have no financial plans to spend, and they have fish with which they can approach the women. They consume alcohol and marijuana because it's easily available in small packs, very cheap, and they need it to feel brave and be strong when they're doing the hard work, particularly if they're doing this at night. So currently, most programs talk about ABC. The fishermen have not benefited from this for two reasons. One, these programs have not been implemented well in this area. But secondly, because it's really not so relevant within the prevailing cultural, economical, and gender frameworks, as I will go on to show you. One of the key informants explained that abstinence was incompatible with local traditions. This is because traditionally, among us Luo people, most of our customs end with sex. Whether it's the planting season or when you want to harvest, everything ends with sex. Additionally, this group of people practice widow inheritance. This means if a woman loses a husband, then a male relative from a husband's side will marry her or cohabit with her, and that relationship is marked with sexual intercourse. If there is no such male relative, then it's the fishermen who are coming from other beaches who can serve as anonymous cleansers. Work and social structures, as well as inequitable access to resources, also influence sexual behavior in this group. This is particularly true for young women, single mothers, and widows. So if a new female wants to enter into the fishing industry, she will continue searching for fish to sell until she finds someone close to her to provide the fish. He will start by giving her small quantities of fish, but will tell her, "I want you to be my lover." Now, this woman will comply because even at home she's been told if she wants to succeed in this business, then she has to form a relationship with a fisherman. Conversely, a woman might initiate a relationship with a boat by putting a net on the boat, then having sexual relationships with the boat owner, and then if the fisherman wants to, you know, collect the money for the fish, she might simply arrange a rendezvous with him. So women enter into these relationships because they want to get the fish to sell, fry, smoke, or dry. They have little money to buy the fish, and they need to compete with middlemen or large-scale traders on the beaches. Conversely, men, particularly if they come from other beaches, will form sexual liaisons to have a ready buyer as well as to gain some homely comforts. So the one who gives the fish is the jaboa, and the one who receives it is the jamaki. And most respondents say that this relationship is a sexual one. But this doesn't mean that everybody is in this relationship. There are couples who have decided in their homes that they will not have other sexual partners, and they remain like that, faithful to each other. Still, most people are of the opinion that when a fisherman sees other nice women, he forgets the children back home and the wife. Even the woman, you could have 5 boats and I have 1, you get along with my wife and have sex because you're giving her money. So there are multiple accounts of multiple sexual relationships, irrespective of marital status, particularly amongst those in the fishing industry who are on larger beaches or away from their own beach. Condom use is inconsistent for all the usual reasons. Additionally, for ritual sex, condom use is not acceptable. We asked, when the condom has been tested and it has proved to be effective, how can we encourage people to continue to use it? One key informant said, had people been thinking about protection, these diseases like AIDS could have been wiped out. People hear but do not care. Men go on admiring faces and big asses without caring about the implications. Others said, lake dwellers have an assumption that AIDS is like any other disease, like malaria, or it is like the way one can be on a journey and involve himself in an accident. Another one said, initially people took AIDS seriously because people were dying and getting infected. But nowadays we say a cow dies with grass in its mouth. If you think of it, it can be considered as an accident, just as if your boat has capsized in the lake. In other words, some fishermen anticipate and accept their death due to the risks inherent in their everyday and routine activities. They cannot stop living their life because of the fear of death. However, they can enjoy their life to the fullest because each day could well be their last. Separately, we found HIV prevalence of 26% in a representative sample of this population of fishermen. Now, these results are commensurate with the qualitative findings that I just presented and urge us to look for more workable strategies for HIV reduction. I can see I'm running out of time, but if I may be allowed one more minute, I'm just summing up. Now, the communities have innovative ideas. I don't know. It's not moving. Okay. Such as rotating funds, diversification of livelihoods, cooperatives with saving and loan schemes, creative behavior change communications, and building local dispensaries that treat sexually transmitted infections. This is all to reduce the threat of HIV/AIDS among their people. However, they need financial and technical support to succeed. So what can we do? Nyanza province has high HIV prevalence. It has funds to treat only about a sixth of those that need ART. And so, according to what the fishermen themselves are suggesting, we need to improve access to livelihoods and basic health and social services, particularly for widows and single mothers, to prevent new infections and save on the funds required for treatment and comprehensive care. I would like to thank my colleagues, the beach management units, the fishermen, and you for your kind attention.
Thank you. That was lovely. We have a name change, but otherwise the same presentation brought to you by Godpower Omoregi, who is a behavioral scientist with the Society for Family Health in Abuja, Nigeria. His presentation is Like Mother, Like Daughter, The Influence of Perceived Mother's Values on Daughter's Attitudes Towards Sexual Abstinence in Nigeria.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'll go straight to present. I also want to say I'm honored and elated that one of the co-chairs this afternoon is the chairman, National Action AIDS Committee in Nigeria. And it's somebody I've cherished. I want to thank him for his visionary leadership in pushing the AIDS agenda forward in Nigeria. Thank you, sir. I'm presenting this on behalf of my other colleagues, Oluwatoyin Adeleke and Dr. Augustine Ankoma. Next slide, please. Now, what we're talking about in terms of like mother, like daughter, is the fact that we all know the importance of the fact that we need to encourage young people to abstain from sex in order to prevent them from contracting HIV. Now, the background information is that in Nigeria and in most other African countries, adolescent reproductive health problems, including HIV, are of important concern. Young persons 15 to 24 years constitute 20% of the total population in Nigeria. Next slide, please. About 1 million births per year in Nigeria are due to teenage mothers. Complications from abortion are responsible for 72% of all deaths among teenagers. 4% of 15 to 19-year-olds in Nigeria are infected with HIV. The family as the basic unit of society is a learning environment for adolescents where values including those related to sexuality are instilled. Discussions about sex with adolescents, particularly girls, are not considered culturally acceptable. Now, the objective of this study was to identify the attitudinal disposition of in-school female adolescents towards sexual abstinence. We also wanted to find out whether a daughter's attitude towards sexual abstinence is influenced by her mother's value and beliefs, which we've operationally defined as subjective norm. The methodology we used, the study utilized both quantitative and qualitative methods of data collection. Questionnaires were self-administered to 371 in-school female adolescent students in Ilesan Remo, Ogun State, Nigeria. 10 focus group discussions were conducted by trained moderators among in-school female adolescents. Simple stratified random sampling technique was utilized. Instruments were designed using specific variables and tested for reliability. More on methodology. We use skills in defining the various variables in terms of their construct. For example, mother-daughter relationship were measured in terms of relatedness, which include blood relationship, closeness, and confidentiality. Communication was measured in terms of dialogue and feedback. Connectedness was also measured in terms of bonding and cordiality. We also looked at self-efficacy, personal attitude, and subjective norm. Data analysis, quantitative data collected were analyzed using the statistical package for social sciences, and qualitative data was analyzed, and concurrent responses were noted and reported. Now, this is just the age of respondents that formed the study. The mean age was 14.7. We also tested for significance between subjective and personal attitude. Here we're saying that if where the subjective norm of the mother is high, it definitely affects, you know, the personal attitude of the daughter. Next slide. Now, what were the results that we found out? We found out that mother's value or belief orientation correlated positively with the personal attitude of the mothers towards sexual abstinence. And this was, you know, very, very significant, because we did find out that where the mother believes in, where the mother subjective norm, no matter what the normative pattern in the society is, for instance, if the norm in the society is believe in abstinence, and the mother subjective norm does not believe in such practices, the daughter is most likely not to believe in abstinence as, you know, a sexual behavior. The results showed that female adolescents who communicate with mothers are more likely to practice abstinence only if the mothers held conservative norms and values, that is, if the mother believes in abstinence. We also tested, you know, subjective norm and personal attitude, and we found that also to be very, very highly significant. The result here again is telling us that the personal attitude of daughters towards sexual abstinence is dependent on the subjective norms as reported on the value belief orientation scale of their mothers towards sexuality. That's slightly emphasized, or that's, you know, it's slightly emphasized what we've said before, that when the mother's, you know, subjective norm, that is what she believes in, is different from what, you know, what the norm is, or what is the desired norm in the society, the daughter is most likely to copy or to take after the mother's belief or the mother's attitudinal disposition. And this is informed, you know, during socialization process, like we all know. Conclusions. What we're concluding here is that mother socialization process correlated positively with personal attitude of mothers towards sexual abstinence. Secondly, mothers play an enormous role in shaping the attitude of their daughters towards sexual abstinence. Daughters who are properly mentored by their mothers are likely to pass across such values to their daughters in future. Values and beliefs are easily imbibed through effective mother-to-daughter communication. Recommendations. Social behavioral problems should be addressed from the primary units of the society, the family. Programs should aim at strengthening parent-to-child communication within the family. Finally, prevention of HIV/AIDS and STIs and unintended pregnancy and other adolescent reproductive health problems can be achieved through effective intrafamily communication. So from our survey, generally, we are saying that mothers have a role to play in terms of, you know, helping us to use abstinence as a preventive measure from, you know, from people contracting HIV. And that's why we've said that it's important that mother's role, particularly within the family, should be strongly emphasized. And this is within the context of the fact that it's, you know, very, very clear that mothers play important role in the socialization process of their daughters. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Our next speaker founded an organization called GRIP Intervention Program, which is in Nelspruit, South Africa. Barbara Kenyon concentrates on abused women and children as her target group.
Good evening or good afternoon. GRIP ran a 2.5-year program with young boy children between the ages of 13 and 18 years, which targeted grade 8 and 9 in the Zilitsha area of Mpumalanga, South Africa. We targeted 3 high-risk schools, believing that the HIV prevention skills and gender sensitivity skills given to the boy child would empower and impact upon the girl child. GRIP used 4 different methods and programs whose core messages were the ABC programs. The participation in the boys in the community work and our bead work and growing vegetable gardens, soccer, sports days, and holiday camps was great. And they highlighted the fact that the boy child really do seek extramural and life skills activities. We really wanted it to work, but it failed. pre- and post-dialogue highlighted the following, that the boy's HIV knowledge on transmission was contradictory, the boy child's risk-taking was still high, and they knew no one who had died of HIV or AIDS. So every Saturday, they go to funerals of young people who have died of TB, pneumonia, cancer, or Slynn's disease. The cultural norms and mixed messages within South Africa impacted repeatedly upon our program. Contradictory messages like how can you be faithful and abstain at the same time, no clear belief on contracting HIV through sex, denial of HIV by the elders, and peer pressure to be 100% man, the boy child has to have or to be seen to have many girlfriends. The boys also said that some of the girls encourage sex and mock the boys who try to abstain. Girls are also allowed to prove fertility by having a child in the early 20s. Africa's societal context in which polygamy and casual relationships are not only culturally and religiously sanctioned, but also to a large extent socially acceptable. And this makes a mockery of the Be Faithful's message. Of the 90 boys that we targeted, only two of them were still living with biological fathers in their household. The remainder of the boys had women-headed households and stepfathers. I quote from one of the boys, "The condoms are deadly devices that carry the disease, as the lubricant is seen as HIV worms when filled with water. Both sexes avoided condom use as a show of love. We noted that both the boys and the girls are not wanting to catch HIV, but circumstances of transmission are complex to them." Family Health International 2005 says that transmission of HIV and other STI infections will persist despite approaches emphasizing ABC, as long as non-consensual sex remains widespread. No prescriptive program like ABC or whatever can be successful unless long-term development programs are put in place to correct the poverty, xenophobia, and discrimination and security. I quote James II, verses 15 to 16. "Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to him, 'Go, I wish you well, keep warm and well-fed,' but does nothing about his physical needs, what good is it?" Currently, laws pertaining to women's and children's rights are not inclusive, both culturally, socially, politically, and legally. Much more work needs to be done to make the efforts of the holistic attention to the country to be more effective in lessening the transmission to HIV. Sorry. High unemployment and other sort of things enhance the gender-based violence. We need to look at how to empower both sexes, that there's not this issue of powers and that kind of abuse of structures which encourage transmission of HIV. High unemployment, under-resourced school, all lead to a diminishing middle class and a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. Our boy children have many dreams, but they cannot dream, and this leads them to apathy, anger, and crime. If we empower schools and resource the learners with access to computers and challenge the teachers to teach, plus engaging in more micro and macro economics, the no hope that the children have presently of a working future that might improve the adherence to any of the ABC approaches. Sorry, doesn't seem to want to move. So I've got a problem with the button right here. What did not help recently was a popular leader whose court case was an example of not abstaining, not being faithful, and not condomizing. Oh. that sets South Africa back a long ways. Leaders, both government, sports, and business, need to be seen as a collective example of good morals and values. We cannot expect it to go from bottom up. Good morals need to come from top down as well. The circumstances where historical cultures have not been addressed, which also perpetuates abuse and fear. Women's buying and concepts of masculinity also need attention. It was strange in the very same trial that I spoke of earlier that the women were probably the most vociferous defenders of the alleged accused. And that says something for where our society is presently in relationship to societal and historical context. We need to mentor, reform, and review the concept of masculinity. We have no answers nor solutions at present, but preventative programs that do make lasting changes to permit transmission need developing. We oppose and wish that funders do not chase good money after feel-good, not evidence-based programs that swoop in and swoop out. It's no good. We feel the ABC program is no good, plus others that are all that transmit the knowledge. But actually, knowledge alone has not changed sex behavior to a safer sex conundrum. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Your comments reminded me of a poster that was downstairs yesterday based on surveys of teenage boys in southern KwaZulu-Natal. If I recall the data off the top of my head, clearly the majority of the boys self-confessed to having beaten, coerced, or raped a girlfriend, and they were under 17 years of age. So clearly a long way to go to build up male esteem and behaviors. The conference organizers very wisely asked Beatrice Ware to do a sort of a wrap-up discussant position. It's hard for me to think of anybody who would do a better job. Beatrice has played a fundamental role in one of the most important NGOs in all of Africa, TASO, in Uganda, and is now with Action Aid. Beatrice.
Thank you. I find this task overwhelming, and by the look of the size of the numbers in the room, I can imagine the expectations. And I want to thank the team of experts. The task that I have this afternoon is really to do an analysis and enable, tease all of us to think through the ABC approach and whether this is making addressing African issues. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to begin on a note that if it was addressing our issues in Africa 25 years into the epidemic, we wouldn't be seeing increasing numbers of women being infected. I do not have any better evidence than to demonstrate the fact that the ABC approach has failed and that we should all be challenged to think beyond this approach. Speaking as a woman activist, as a woman who abstained, as a woman who was faithful when I got married but still got HIV, I don't think there's any better evidence than hearing it from the horse's mouth. I would like to say that the ABC approach begins on a failure note when it takes on a note that assumes control, that women have a degree of control, that they can abstain when they are young girls, that when we get married, we choose to be faithful, which most of us do, but it also places a lot of burden on women. A woman can only account for herself, but not for the actions of her partner. A woman can only account for her own faithfulness, not for the actions of her co-wives if she's in a polygamous relationship. And when we choose to use a condom, I don't know in what instances, but for most of us, we know how difficult it can be to influence that decision. Where does the power lie? 25 years into the epidemic, the ABC approach has ignored the powerlessness, the gender dynamics, the difficult choices that many women in Africa have got to make. The other dimension to this approach, which was well articulated by the speakers, is the fact that the real cultural context that we live in Africa, where male patriarchy, where the economic control of economic tools that enable us to buy a condom if we want to, still lie in the hands of men. We have heard over the last 3 days that male circumcision is another breakthrough, another tool to empower men and to reduce women's choices. The social framework, the cultural values, and all those things that have been discussed still continue to entrench male patriarchy and reduce women's power, especially in terms of decision making. The fact that women, most women in Africa, cannot even make a decision on when to have sex, how to have sex, where to have sex, how can we say the ABC approach addresses our realities. The approach, again, assumes, or let me just say this differently. From my own experience, the ABC approach has tended to heighten stigma towards women. It has even been worsened when the C over the last 3 years has got struck off through programs that have tended to promote the moralistic approach to prevention. By implication through these programs, especially the AB approach, which we know has become a nightmare, a devil, a tool of murder in Africa, what we see for women like myself is a new wave of stigma. For women who are infected, when we stand up to say we are infected today, what happens is the questions run through people's minds. She was careless because she didn't abstain. When she got married, maybe she was promiscuous. She was unfaithful by implication. If she did, let her join the risk group and try the condom. Increasingly, these programs are fueling the epidemic on the African continent. The other issue that comes out very clearly from the presentations, is the whole issue around women's economic status and the dependency on men and the desperation for survival. Women having to make these difficult situations every day. The ABC approach ignores these underlying factors that make women very vulnerable and the issues of poverty that most women in Africa find themselves in. Unless we address poverty, unless we address the underlying effects, we cannot talk about the ABC approach in a realistic manner. 25 years into the epidemic, this is the greatest injustice I have ever seen. The other issue that we saw coming out, especially from the fishing community, is the issue of complacency. Because people do not seem to feel that we are making progress, the fishermen continue to see death in their daily lives in Nyanza. Does that mean that they don't see the condoms? That they do not know how to abstain? That these women cannot be faithful? The analysis speaks for itself. Why are they complacent? The question is to you, to both you and I. Are we making progress, therefore? If people can behave in the manner that we have seen, should we, therefore, continue preaching these programs? Should we, therefore, be thinking about A, B, C, and beyond? The other issue that comes to my mind, and also from the analysis, is looking at what comes out from the family values, the experience from Nigeria. From my own analysis, what I see from here, and again asking myself a provocative question from what we have learned in the past, is the whole issue about the family as a source of empowerment, education, and information. However, what is most important for me in analyzing this whole discussion is, what about the role of the fathers? What about the role of men? The whole burden of passing on values being left to women, and how far can women go? When these children get married, do the women remain with the power after they have been exchanged for bride price? Who makes the decision? Do their mothers, are their mothers with them, especially when they are girls, to make sure that they are supported to deal with the difficult decisions around having safer sex? If they are boys, are their mothers anywhere near to tell them that battering your partner when she says no is a terrible thing? Who has the power? Where are the men? Allow me, ladies and gentlemen, to also question the, I don't remember which discussion, but in terms of the messages that are passed on, but I think it's still about the values. It's about the recommendation that the family is a source of information, and it is an effective way of passing on messages. But what kind of messages do we pass on in these families? And who is passing them on? What sort of messages are those, the messages that we do not want to name the private parts in Africa? Are they still the messages where we are ashamed to talk about sex and sexuality? Are we still talking about the conservative messages of shame and silence and fearing to address sex in its entirety? Are they messages that allow young people the right to information, or deny them the right to information while relegating them to the risk of HIV? So we need to check what information the children are getting. The other dimension, again, that I would like you to allow me to mention here, is the risk in marriage. Increasingly, we are seeing a growing risk in marriage, a growing risk to HIV, more married women getting infected because of domestic violence, and the fact that in Africa, marital rape is not recognized 25 years into the epidemic. This is what is happening. And therefore, does ABC work? Is it still relevant for a continent which has 70% of the infections but still denies to address marital rape? Allow me to extend it to another angle, which the presenters did not touch on. I feel very strongly that the programs of ABC, but mostly the abstinence only and faithfulness, has unleashed stigma and denial, has entrenched it in Africa because of the fear of addressing sex and sexuality. It enables those leaders that want to keep their heads in the sand to keep them there and even keep them deeper into the sand. And as a person living with HIV, I feel very strongly that these programs are responsible for undermining the meaningful involvement of people living with HIV. And this is something that we cannot afford to lose 25 years into this epidemic. Therefore, where do we go from here? And I would like to make four recommendations. One is that in Africa, leadership needs to move beyond the rhetoric. There's been too much rhetoric for the last 25 years. This conference is about time to deliver. And time to deliver, and my first call goes to our own leaders that are embracing moralistic programs that undermine human rights, that do not recognize the vulnerability of women, that export programs that have been known to fail in the United States over the last 20 years to Africa. And it's high time we as citizens of the world, and more so African citizens, that we held our leaders accountable. We cannot allow Africa to be wiped away because our leaders are trying to be politically correct. Adding on to leadership where one of our leaders we know, we call him the bath and the shower, is that so? Is that the term in South Africa? I think it is. I would like to take it to another leg and challenge us as women and challenge all women leaders in this room and at this conference that 25 years into the epidemic, some of the women leaders have not used the spaces that they are occupying to challenge denial, stigma, and they have actually enabled the programs that fail women, that fail Africa, to thrive. We know that in some countries where women are raped every minute, where violence against women is a big problem, where the infection rates are on the increase, we have got women leaders who have the guts to say antiretroviral treatment is not the solution for Africa. This same leadership caused a chill for some of us who are at Angus when the same leaders were very hard on putting targets into the Angus document. Today, as we speak in Toronto, we have got one of the smartest booths where garlic and olive oil is what is on that booth. And I would like you to visit that booth if you want to know what kind of leadership we have in Africa. The question to ask ourselves, do we have the right leadership to cause an impact on this crisis? Do we have leadership that is in denial, stigma, window dressing, rhetoric? We need to stop and ask ourselves. Only the truth shall save Africa. We must get out of shame. We must stand up, however uncomfortable the truth might be. Let us face it, we have got to talk about AIDS, and we can't avoid to talk about sex and sexuality. Whether it's in our families, whether it's in the corridors, we have got to talk about it. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, let us tap and utilize the power of leaders and advocate for evidence-based prevention. I thank you very much.
Look, Beatrice. I knew you would sock it to him. I just want to point out two quick factoids. Since the discussion has been brought up about leadership, the former Vice President of South Africa and head of the South African AIDS Commission was involved in a rape. Most of you follow the story of Jacob Zuma, and you may recall that he said in testimony, admitting that he had taken the woman who was HIV positive, "Well, I took a shower afterwards." What message did that send to the men of South Africa? That A, you can get away with rape, he was acquitted, and B, that you can take care of your risk of acquiring HIV through the act of rape by taking a shower. The other factoid I wanted to point out, any of you that might not have been in the first late breaker session this morning in Track C, a paper by Schaefer et al., very important, showed that the incidence of HIV has been steadily rising in Uganda since 1999. And Uganda is cited as the great case example of success with ABC. So this data is a warning, perhaps. I'm going to yield the chair now to my esteemed colleague from Nigeria.
Thank you, Laurie. And I just also want to thank Beatrice for such elucidation. I think that it could not have been better said. I just want to say something before we take questions. And that is the fact that in 1994, a good number of us, and I'm sure some of you in this room, gathered in Cairo, and we signed the ICPD document, which, in my view, was a milestone in the areas of women's empowerment, and ensured that women, if we had followed that route, would have been able to take possession of their lives and be able to empower themselves in order to protect themselves, not only against sexually transmitted infections and HIV/AIDS, but also economic empowerment and all of these gender issues that we're talking about today. Unfortunately, somewhere down the road, HIV/AIDS hijacked the entire process, and we disconnected reproductive health from HIV. Now, what we're here talking about at this conference, and certainly what Beatrice had eloquently talked about, is for us to step back into that mode and ensure that we empower women sufficiently to be able to take care of themselves, and also to recognize that men are entirely more vulnerable than they think they are, and put in place men programs that address men so that they can be more responsible. And after having said my piece, we'll take a few questions, and we have about 15 minutes, and so we will take maybe about 5 questions, and I want you to be as brief as possible so that you can yield the floor. We have 30 minutes, okay. We can take more then, so we can yield the floor.
Can we put the lights up so that we can see each other in the audience? Can we bring the lights up a bit?
Now, as you come to the mic to ask your question, please identify yourself and your attribution, where you come from. Thank you. Sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joshua from Kenya. I work with the National AIDS Council. Mr. Chairman, I want to begin by congratulating our presenters and your chair for the work that we have had this afternoon. I have two questions. First is how do we reconcile the information Kevin has given with the presentation from Nigeria? Our friend from Nigeria did say that the correlation of 30% is significant. And I thought from my statistics, 0.33 was too low to say that was too significant, given just like Kevin. So how can the two gentlemen reconcile that information between the behavior change and that they were trying to measure? Second question is on Beatrice. We hear her loud and clear, and we stand with her. But I thought there's a difference between if ABC as a program has not worked, and also the difference between the way it has been implemented. Because are we saying in Africa there were no cases even before HIV and AIDS was there, where societies were not encouraging people to abstain, whether boys, whether girls, and were highly regarded, where girls and boys remain virgins? Are we saying those cases are not there? I want to stand this afternoon and say I have many cases, though not documented, where girls and boys were rewarded in society because they remained virgins until marriage. Thank you.
No, I think you
want to
take the first.
Okay. I think the easiest way to address the discrepancy between the information that I presented and what our colleague from Nigeria presented is the difference between behavior and belief and attitude. The focus in the presentation that I gave was only on the behaviors themselves. And as we know, behaviors are more difficult to affect. I think as we heard from the eloquent discussion that we had at the end of our presentations, having the right attitudes and having the right beliefs doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be protected and going to be able to act on those behaviors. So there is a gulf between the two, and I think that the difference between the Nigerian presentation and my summary of the evidence elucidates that particular gulf.
I also want to add that we never said a significant level of 0.33 is very significant. What we pointed out, if you look at the slide very well, is that it was significant at 0.001 and not 0.003. I'm surprised that that did come up. Thank you.
Thank you. In any case, I think Kevin was talking of a meta-analysis, and this was a specific study that was being reported. So it's not the same. Yes. Sir.
Mike, too. Yes, Beatrice suggested that we be not politically correct, so I'm prepared to do that. Given that, if I'd looked at DHS survey data from non-countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and the majority of youth 15 to 24 were abstinent in the past year, the majority of married people only had one sexual partner in the past year. So given that, how can we claim that ABC is impractical and cannot be practiced if the majority of people are already doing it? Secondly, I'm sorry, Tom Davis with Food for the Hungry. And also a question for Kevin O'Reilly. I'm really glad you actually presented some scientific results. I think we need to be looking at actual studies to make a decision on this and not rhetoric. But you said some donors have focused almost exclusively on abstinence. And given U.S. public law, this is 108.25, assures that one-third of U.S. foreign aid assistance for prevention of HIV goes to abstinence and being faithful. 50% goes to prevention not related to sexual behavior. The remaining 17% goes to prevention efforts not related to abstinence or being faithful, such as condoms. That means the majority is going to things other than A and B, 63%. Also, the U.S. government is the largest single provider of condoms in the world. We distributed 612 million condoms in 2005. Annual condom procurement has gone up steadily under PEPFAR. So given that, who are these donors who are focusing almost exclusively on abstinence in the prevention efforts? It doesn't seem to fit the data. Thank you.
Kevin?
What you say is true. The U.S. government provides the largest amount of condoms, and the U.S. government does set aside monies for non-AB activities as well. However, the reports that we constantly, I mean, that's what we hear from Washington, and I can only believe it. The reports that we hear from the field, however, are often that as it gets percolated down and applied at the field level, U.S. government funding does not translate into increase in condoms availability in some places. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but those are the reports that we hear. And I think that's what leads to the controversy that we're hearing in this room today.
But it's anecdotal.
Can't hear you.
You did say that's based on reports, or anecdotal reports, not based on actual data that says we're not providing condoms. And A and B are definitely parts of that strategy, and so we are also promoting being faithful. It's not an abstinence-only program.
It's true.
Then, do you want to say something? Does anyone want to say something? Do you want to say something? Yes.
I'd like to use Uganda as an example to answer the issue about the U.S. government being the biggest provider of condoms. I think what is important for people to understand is that those of us who challenge these policies usually people misunderstand the fact that we appreciate that the U.S. government is the biggest provider of, first of all, treatment. For instance, under PEPFAR, more people than ever before have been enrolled on treatment. We have also seen that the U.S. provides condoms, but let's get the figures right. What is available from statistics is that three condoms are provided for Africa per man per year. So are you talking big volumes? Let's go per. We need to talk about these per capita. Three condoms per man in Africa per year. And that is, you know, we need to be analytical when we are talking about this. The other thing is from when you look at Uganda, if you do an analysis, which we have done because we've been tracking this for quite some time, in 2004, the U.S. provide most of the funding under PEPFAR, and I hope there are experts in this room who can allude to this, 50% of the funding went towards AB. 2005, 60%, around close to 60%, went towards AB. 2006, about 60% again towards AB. So increasingly, we have seen more funding under PEPFAR go towards AB. And therefore, if we look at the volume of funding, we need to look at what goes where and also who gets that funding. It's the moralistic, faith-based organizations that stigmatize the condom, that push for AB, that badmouth the condom, and is this where the U.S. taxpayers' money should be going? Advise me for those from the U.S. in the room.
No. My name is Kit Grandin. I'm from North Iowa, one of the states in the United States. I don't have a good answer for that last question. I want to take Beatrice Ware's challenge with my question, which is, how long are we going to pander to the term be faithful? As Ms. Sharma and Ms. Kenyon pointed out, being faithful to the traditions in their respective areas is not what be faithful is in a fundamentalist Western monotheistic regime. It isn't being faithful. Having a second son take a widow as the next wife is being faithful to a tradition in Africa and in other parts of the world. The whole term of be faithful is a sham. It's particular to Western monotheism and not to the rest of us. How long are we going to pander to the very existence of the term be faithful?
I agree. That was what the boys actually came up in their simplistic ways, that the societal norms and our cultural norms are often at odds. And what we could say in one culture from America is what is normal for us and societally correct for us is not necessarily the same and prescriptive to everywhere in the world. And traditions do need to be respected, and there are always ways to work around that.
Second mic.
Thank you. First of all, I wanted to begin by saying that it seems that the room is particularly hostile to the anti-condom or to the AB-focused approach. And I wanted to thank the people in the room who are equally enthusiastic about the A and the B approach for their faith in human nature. I think that those of us, and I consider myself one of that group, who don't believe that A and B are the most effective, it's simply because we all agree, I think everyone here agrees, that abstinence is without a doubt the most effective way of preventing the transmission of this virus. However, I think that most of us feel that it's not realistic, and until gender and cultural change is a reality, an A-B focused approach isn't a reliable means. So just to say thank you to those of you who do have faith in human nature. Secondly, I just had a question just to pose to the Nigerian colleagues. I'm Madeleine from Vancouver. I work with the Canadian Red Cross. I was wondering, in regards to your data, you mentioned that the average age was 14.7 of the people who you were in communication with. And I was wondering if you felt that that was an age at which the youth were really experiencing sustained and concentrated pressure to engage in sexual behavior, or if you feel that that pressure really begins later on in life, and therefore if perhaps 14.7 isn't the best age to begin analyzing their belief in abstinence, because it hasn't really been put to the test, so to speak, so far. And also whether or not you could speak to any assurances of anonymity that were given to the participants of the survey, so that we can know that the data really is reliable and that they weren't feeling pressured and may have changed their answers as a result of that.
Thank you very much for your question. I'll start from the last point you raised. The participants were not pressured at all because it was a self-administered questionnaire, and that gave them, you know, the leverage of responding objectively to the questions asked. And ethically, in Nigeria, doing researches among ages less than 15, you know, something particularly that has something that has to do with sexual behavior, it's something that, you know, you don't get easy with. So the age bracket, I'm not saying, I know sexual debut, you know, starts, you know, before then, given, depending on the population you're looking at. But we looked at 15 to 24 because conventionally that's, you know, how you go about sexual behavior or behavioral research, that you won't commit ethical faults.
Thank you. My name is Heiner Großkurt from the Medical Research Council in Uganda. I'm one of the co-investigators of the study which was quoted a few minutes ago, which this morning in the late breaker was displayed in great detail by my colleague, Leanne Schaefer. I beg your pardon, but I need to make a correction about the facts which were displayed and what we heard here. Uganda has been successful in reducing the epidemic, and the prevalence and incidence in the area which we reported this morning has been falling throughout the 1990s. Since about 2000, the prevalence and incidence is no longer falling, but we haven't said that it is steeply rising. And just to give truth the honor, I would like to correct this. The message there is the same. We all need to re-emphasize the prevention efforts in this country, and I think this is going to be true for many other parts of Africa. So the basic message is the same, re-emphasize of the epidemic, but it is not correct to say that the incidence is steeply rising. This would be a disaster, and I hope we can stop it before it comes to that.
Thank you. Number two.
Thank you. Tim Shand with the International Planned Parenthood Federation. I think I sense a general agreement within the room that abstinence-only approach is an ABC, but particularly abstinence-only is ineffective and is fundamentally flawed. I think we all accept the evidence, and I think we all accept, or at least those of us who believe in an effective public health approach accept that there is no evidence, full evidence base for abstinence only, and indeed, often people who abstain from vaginal sex through abstinence often end up taking part in anal sex or oral sex and then put themselves at greater risk of HIV. But my question is, I've been very heartened by the fact that throughout this conference we've had these discussions about ABC and that we are coming to that general acceptance of the need for us as people who care about HIV prevention, as people who want to see an end to the epidemic and want to see the debate to move forward. I think that we need to be then also providing an alternative. I think we need to be building a movement around saying we have the evidence that shows that ABC doesn't work, and we need now to be gathering the evidence as is happening to say that instead what does work is comprehensive sexuality education. I just want to add that as an organisation, IPPF fully promotes with its partners comprehensive sexuality education, and you can get more information about that on our website. But I wanted to put a question to the panellists was, do you believe that comprehensive sexuality education can be the alternative? And if so, how can we build that social movement so that next time when we come to the conference, we can be showing the evidence base for why that is much more effective?
I've been asked to speak, so I don't think ABC in and of itself is flawed. It's just it's not enough. And so comprehensive education and on sexuality would be excellent. I think it depends from country to country how open they are and at what age and how much do you say. But I think at this point more governments would be open to that than not. However, I also want to go back to what the fishermen were saying, that their lives are such, the way we do business, the way we relate as men and women, all these things also contribute to sexuality and how sexual activity takes place. So I don't think there's one answer. I think we can all stand behind sort of an integrated approach which has been tailored to suit the country, the ethnic group, age, class, caste that one is talking to.
I'd
also like to add that a lot of the ABC programs and that do not engage the traditional healers, of whom is a large part of all of our society, I would say, in Africa. And so it's not comprehensive in dealing with all the medical role players that are involved and that can be used to create a more holistic prevention process. Nobody has ever, as far as I know, has embarked on working with traditional healers in culturally seeing how to use their beliefs and their knowledge in helping us fight the transmission.
Well, thank you for an enlightening presentation. I think that in the midst of all these criticisms, we need to be careful not to generalize. I'm aware that there seems to be an excitement, particularly with the global conferences, where people tend to become more prominent by being rebellious or so. And I think this needs to be, we need to sober up and to look at issues more in perspective, in its context. Firstly, I think that particularly as a man, I feel that men are becoming an endangered species. Particularly as an African, there were a number of things which were mentioned about the rape case that involved Jacob Zuma in South Africa. Jacob Zuma, the fact is that the court of law acquitted him of rape. That's the first truth. The second truth is that after the trial, he publicly apologized for some of the things that he said in court and some of the things that he did. Now, what is important to note there is that our leaders are as human as we are. At this conference, at this particular conference, when Bill Clinton speaks, we give him a standing ovation. But he is no different from what Jacob Zuma did.
Wait, you know,
I'm going to stop you then.
But I think everybody needs to hear.
I think you need to give me an opportunity to speak. Yes. If you don't agree with what I say, it's fine. It is not a problem if you don't agree with what I say. But you need to be tolerant and understand what I'm saying.
Carry on, finish.
You see, this is the problem.
I said finish.
That you want us to agree, you want me to agree with what you're saying.
No, we want you to finish.
The voice of dissenters is not bad.
We want you to finish what you are saying.
As an African man, I have never raped a woman as I stand in front of you. And I feel offended every time that we criticize, we generalize. I have never raped a woman. I have never abused a woman. And I never will. As a person living with HIV, I am involved personally in changing the perspectives that you keep referring to in general terms. It is quite offensive for people to just generalize in their criticisms for no particular reason. And I think that it is important for all of us to realize that as much as we are leaders and we are activists in this field, we are all part of humanity. We are all humans, and we need to focus more on issues that continue to build us. If I have an idea that doesn't work, it should not be killed. We must learn from the activities and the concepts that we have employed. Thank you.
Mic two.
Thank you. I'm Arushi Singh. I'm from the South Asia region, so I just wanted to bring in a different perspective because we're talking about Africa. To begin with, I was just curious whether anyone in this room can actually tell me if they know a mother who encourages her daughters to go and have sex. You know? I have also yet to see a woman, a gay man, an injecting drug user, or a sex worker supporting the ABC approach. And I think these key populations are actually the key to the work that we are doing, and I'm sure we all understand this. To refer to my colleague who just spoke, and the very few colleagues over here who actually are, agreeing to the ABC approach being effective, I would like to know how the ABC approach helped Bhanvari Devi in India, who was punished for preventing child marriage by being gang raped. How Mukhtar Anmai in Pakistan, who was gang raped by the village council because her brother was having an affair, could have been helped by the ABC approach. How Imrana in India, who was raped by her father-in-law, and then was ordered by the religious leaders to leave her husband and live with her father-in-law, could have been saved by the ABC approach. I think the impression is that maybe we, living in the South, are all barbarians and we need to be saved by a Western right-wing fundamentalist ideology. Thank you.
Again, thanks for your points. But I think something that we need to get right here is the fact that nobody is saying we should, at least my presentation didn't say abstinence alone, you know, is the answer. But what is very fundamental is the fact that we need to do all approaches. I think from a health communication perspective, an approach that gives people the option to choose from is the best approach. And if people want to abstain, fine. But the fact that, you know, you want to say because, well, abstinence is not working, which perhaps I don't really subscribe to, is the fact that we need to know which approach, you know, best suits country situation and specific cultural contexts. And that is what should be applied. So we should look at an approach that, you know, gives option, like, or if that's what somebody called a comprehensive approach. For example, in our program in Nigeria, we promote all three approaches. And most tertiary institution students, there is that, you know, thought that many of them are promiscuous. But from comprehensive surveys we've done, many of them are actually abstaining. But because it's socially desirable to say I've had sex, even those who have not had sex will claim to have had sex. So we need to balance, you know, all this. That what we're saying is that an approach that provides options for people to pick from is the best approach. Let's not bracket people either into abstinence, being faithful, or use condom. Let's allow people to choose an approach that best suits their cultural and personal situations.
every good thing must come to an end. We have only time for one more question. So I'll take that from microphone one.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Elizabeth Madra. I'm the program manager for the AIDS Control Program and STDs in the Ministry of Health in Uganda. I'd wanted to just make a correction of the increased incident, which has been said already. But what I wanted is to share my experiences as a program manager since 1993 about the issue of ABC. The panelists made a very good discussion, presentation, and then, of course, Beatrice, you did a very good analysis. But I would suggest that we don't dispel completely the ABC approach. I've liked what is coming out as a recommendation. This needs to be expanded, probably to include other preventive approaches. Because if we take, for instance, Uganda all these years, we've applied the ABC. In three, as a trinity, you can't remove the A, you can't remove the B. You need to use all the A, B, and the C. Now, take, for instance, we started condom consumption in 1980s, where our level of consumption was even less by 7 million. When I came to the program in 1993, our consumption for condom was about 7 to 8 million. Today, we are buying 120 million condoms per year for consumption, which means there's quite a lot which may have been changed in people's sexual behavior. Here, what I would say is also the consistency use of the condoms. As we expand on the ABC, we need to ensure that the condoms for prevention are consistently used. You find a community where a condom is being kept to keep cigarettes, which are smoked, very dry. You find a community where men are working in a salt factory and they are using the condom to protect themselves from getting injured. So here, let us not dispel completely the ABC strategy. Can we expand on it? In the absence of microbicides, in the poverty in which we are living today, what would be the recommendation of the panelists for programs, interventions in the 25 years down the epidemic if the ABC does not work? We want that recommendation to come out from the panelists.
Thank you very much. I am going to yield the floor to my co-chair to make concluding remarks, and then we shall round off.
Well, thanks all for sitting through this. I think it's very important, and maybe a little less than we got here in this room. When you talk about abstinence, you talk about faithfulness, you talk about condoms, and you talk about sexual norms, it becomes a heated conversation across cultures, across genders. It's important that you not just talk, but you learn to listen. For all of you who did, I hope you enjoyed it and got something out of it. Thank you very much.